because he tried. He mended fences with Jordan, with Saudi Arabia, and with other conservative regimes in the Arab world. And you know, he concentrated on trying to rebuild the Egyptian armed forces. And,
but did Iraq at this point see itself as a potential rival for leadership?
No, not really.
Because
no.
There was no comparable charismatic Iraqi leader at that point.
No. No, and I think we realize that we can't aspire to, because after all, we took a very minor role in the war, and we had no right to lecture others about it. And of course, we were terribly disappointed, and I think that weakened the government, because you have one of the questions, whether that, the last question, whether that contributed to the to the Ba'athist coup of 1968. It
right.
did, in fact, yes.
You think it did?
It did. Because it weakened the government completely. It, a lot of the nationalist elements in the country, you know, were disenchanted with the government, and they turned away from them, and they saw that the Ba'athists probably would be too. And they tried, of course, after the war, they tried to reverse the sort of the policy which was to keep away from Nasser. They changed the government and brought in a very Nasser, a very, close Nasserist, people close to Nasserism, and they took over in 1967, when I was replaced, and I was reappointed immediately the same day as permanent representative again.
Right.
Yes. That was in while we were in the midst of our debates in the General Assembly in July 1967, we were voting on the various draft resolutions. You saw that, you know.
Yes, and I wanted to ask further on that, because a great deal of attention was paid to the General Assembly. It was a special session.
Yes, because the security, the Russians asked for it, because the Security Council could not deal with the matter anymore.
Right, and in fact, Gromyko was there, I believe, and Dobrynin.
I think Kosygin came himself. He came to this, and then he met at Glassboro, where it was known?
With the President.
With the President,
yes,
yeah.
Right. But in the end, how do you assess the significance of that special session?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, it was a failure for the Arabs, because they were not able to get a resolution asking, you know, in a very clear way for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the occupied territories. I mean, that was our main... the Latin American draft, which was supported by the United States and unopposed by Israel, asked, you know, in a very clearly that the Israeli troops should be withdrawn from the occupied territories. But they asked that they're, in return, we should renounce the state of belligerency. And I urged very strongly my Arab colleagues at the time to accept the Latin American draft.
You did?
Very much. Latin American draft resolution. But people who were not, I mean, the Algerians and the Syrians and the, you know, the sort of the radical regimes. And the Egyptians were also in favor of the Latin American draft. But we couldn't, and unfortunately we had to vote against it, which was, I think, a disaster.
It was not. No,
I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it would have changed everything very much, because the Israelis were determined not to withdraw unless they were subjected to extreme pressure from the United States. And I don't know whether they are prepared to do that, really, the United States. I mean, Johnson was still president, of course.
Although I think when you read the documents that have been released,
yeah,
you'll find that Golda Meir actually was prepared for to trade the territory for peace.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't know this at the time, I judge.
No.
You didn't believe it. It was the last chance, as a matter of fact. None of the Israeli governments after that,
yeah,
after Golda Meir, until Rabin.
But are you, I mean, what are these documents you're talking about?
There are American documents in which this is reported.
But very clearly, I mean, saying that...
Yeah. And they do show that the Americans favored that.
Yeah. Do you like to have another coffee?
No, this is fine. But at that time, on the Iraqi side, and for that matter on the Arab side, there was no belief that it was possible to get the return of the territory.
Well, I certainly didn't believe that, and myself. But of course, I went along with the Egyptians. And I mean, 242 was negotiated mainly by the Egyptians and Jordanians,
mm-hmm,
with the
British,
with the British and the United States, of course. I was involved in a, you know, they used to consult me and report to me what is happening. With Mahmoud Riyad and Abdul Munim Rifai, both dead now, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, I kept on saying, fine, if you can get a resolution which would help us. Although I kept on being, showing my skepticism.
Did you, or did anybody on the Arab side, appreciate the significance of the missing "the" in the draft?
Well, I mean, it was noticeable, obviously. And we were told at the time, don't worry about that. I was told by Carradine himself, you know, who I think...
he introduced the resolution.
His resolution, probably he drafted it anyway. And he said, no, this is, you know, there would have to be some minor rectifications of the frontier. You know, which would be mutually acceptable by both sides. But I mean, obviously, I mean, if you read the whole resolution with the preamble, mm-hmm, the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war and so on, and the withdrawal from territories, I mean, when you read it together, obviously, the withdrawal has to be almost complete, certainly substantial from most of the territories. Not what Netanyahu is offering now, obviously.
That's something very different.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that...
So we thought, I mean, okay, fine, there will be minor things, and but of course, with time, the Israelis were asking more and more and more. And of course, on Jerusalem, there were two resolutions. That's why I'm wondering whether any resolutions the General Assembly would have much effect, because there are two resolutions from the General Assembly, one from the Security Council in Jerusalem, in which, you know, they asked Israel to rescind all its you know, measures that it has taken to incorporate Jerusalem. Of course, nothing happened. So I was wondering whether even if the Latin American drought had gone through, whether it would have been implemented. You say that Golda Meir was prepared, maybe. I don't know, because, you know...
That's a question about Jerusalem. I should add that.
Yeah.
That's the one,
yeah,
part that you might not have returned.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, I mean, the whole pattern is that, you know, they ask for something, and when finally we accept to do it,
mm-hmm,
then we are presented with new demands. For example, let's have direct negotiations. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We've been having these direct negotiations for so long. And
now
we recognize Israel. We recognize Israel. Do this and that and
right.
that. Yeah.
Were you aware, a little later on, of the secret contacts between Golda Meir and her government and King Hussein?
We heard rumors about it, but I wasn't sure. But I mean, we knew that King Abdullah certainly had contacts with him.
Yes,
and
he got
we heard rumors about King Hussein having contacts, and I think probably the Egyptians knew about them, and they hoped to embarrass him with them or to make use of them. But I certainly did not have any hard information about that.
So this was not an element affecting the relationship among the Arab countries at that point?
No, unfortunately, you know, in Khartoum, the three no's, the famous no negotiation, no recognition, no whatever it is.
Right, right.
Which was another mistake, of course.
At that time, certainly.
At that time, yes.
Certainly. Now, I wanted to ask again about the Palestinians in terms of refugees. What 242 does cover that.
Yes.
But what did you realistically see and other people on the Arab side that you were in contact as the likely solution of the then called refugee problem? Did you believe that there could be a return, especially of those who had...
Not really. No, I mean, we knew the Israelis would never accept that.
Yeah.
And maybe they would be prepared to make adequate compensation with, of course, American financial help. And also maybe return a token number of Palestinians. And but we had no illusions about their accepting hundreds of thousands of Palestinians coming back. I mean, but possibly as part of a overall peace settlement, something can be done for compensation, for resettlement, and for... but we had no illusions. I mean, I certainly had no illusions myself that the Israelis will ever accept for a large number of Palestinians to come back.
Because that means
they said that, you know, a comparable number, although that's not true, of Jews from the Arab world also went to Israel. So, I mean, there was a... they keep on saying that there was a natural exchange of population. That's another matter, of course.
Although there is a relationship there, because I think Iraq is the only country that did not accept any of the Palestinian refugees. Why was that?
No, I don't think I tell you, for one thing, the Palestinian leadership did not want the Palestinians to go to Iraq, but the about 30,000 to 40,000 who went to Iraq did not live in refugee camps.
Mm-hmm.
They were integrated into Iraqi society. And
there were that many who went there?
About 30,000, 35,000. Mm-hmm. But they all became part of Iraq. I mean, they were not in refugee camps.
Mm-hmm.
They became part of Iraqi society. They worked in this and that and the other, and in all walks of life, you know.
Because I had understood.
So, and we gave them, probably we were better than the other Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of resettling a large number of Palestinians in Iraq, of course, is something that the Iraqis will not accept, because the Palestinians would not accept that, because it would weaken their claim to go back to Palestine. Also, there's another element which is not being mentioned often, because it's in a way taboo. If you get hundreds of thousands or a million Palestinians in Iraq at that time, especially, it would change the demographic balance between, especially, all the Palestinians are Sunnis, and the Shia majority in Iraq would, and the Kurds also, minority in the north, would feel rather threatened if this huge influx of Sunni Arabs comes into Iraq. I assure you, a lot of the militant Shias would reject that. And also, the Kurds have always, whenever there was any rapprochement or a talk of unity between Iraq and other Arab countries, they were extremely concerned, and they tried their best to combat it. They said, no, Iraq has to stay as it is. You know. So, now, of course, they're still talking. there's still talk around, going around, that perhaps eventually a lot of the Palestinians who are still in refugee camps in Syria and Jordan and Lebanon, they could be resettled in Iraq. There will be difficulties. I mean, maybe some Palestinians now feel maybe that's their best hope, because they're not going to go back and all that. And
economically, Iraq was in the best position to
absorb. Of course, it can absorb. I mean, there's no doubt Iraq can absorb, but not now, obviously. But they could have absorbed a large number. But as I said, there were two problems. One, the Palestinians didn't want to do that. Mm. And secondly, of course, a large part of Iraqi society was a little hesitant about it. Although the Palestinians who did come to Iraq were treated very well, and they, as I said, they completely were absorbed in Iraqi society.
Now, I have this question, this leading question here, but if putting oneself back into the mentality of 1967, did you, or do you think other Arab leaders, other than King Hussein, perhaps, were you able to visualize any resolution of the so-called Middle East problem that included a continuation of the existence of Israel?
Yes, I think actually the Arabs accepted de facto the existence of Israel when they signed the armistice agreements.
Already then.
In 1949. And the Lausanne Protocol in 1949, I think it was,
right.
Or 50, I'm not sure, yeah. Well, I mean, the Arabs accepted the partition plan, more or less, because the maps of the partition plan were annexed to the protocol, the Lausanne Protocol, which means that since 1949, the Arabs accepted the existence of Israel within the frontiers which were decided by the United Nations.
By the General Assembly.
By the partition resolution. And this is what Eban said, which I think is really behind the armistice frontiers established by agreement between Israel and its Arab neighbors in 1949. The national life of sovereign states has become crystallized in an increasingly stable mold. There is some evidence that thoughtful minds in the Middle East are becoming skeptical about threats to change the existing territorial and political structure by armed force. Such threats and the policies concocted to support them offend the spirit and the letter of the United Nations Charter. They violate bilateral agreements freely negotiated and solemnly signed. Many undermine the central principles of international civility, for they encounter insuperable obstacles in the opposition of the world community to the alteration by aggressive force of legally established and internationally recognized situations. We regard the present armistice plans as immune from change without consent. I mean, this would be the perfect Arab position.
Well, it would have been
so eloquently expressed by Al Tayyip.
That, in a way, should have been, I think, the Arab position.
Yes.
This isn't part of our conversation, but in fact, Abba Eban is now one of those who...
He's a love, of course. He wants to... he supports a Palestinian state.
He still supports that same position, in a way.
In a way, yes. Yes. Well, I think that would have been the... and of course, after 1967, the Arabs maintained that they would recognize Israel within its frontiers, which were more or less the armistice. You see, in 1949, they accepted the partition Israel under the partition resolution. 1967 they accepted Israel after the armistice agreements, which of course meant more territory than the partition, as you know. I mean,
right.
The whole of Western Galilee, which was supposed to be part of the Arab state, was incorporated in Israel, and the Arabs accepted that in 1967. You know. So this idea of the Arabs want the elimination of Israel and to throw the Israelis in the sea, I think it's good Israeli propaganda, but in fact it's not the truth.
Although,
I mean, people talk about it.
Well, of course, isn't this one of the elements of tension introduced in the relationship between the Palestinians when they became more organized and the Arab states? Because the Palestinians, of course, did include in their, what is it, their national covenant, the call for the elimination.
Not really. I mean, what the national covenant said is that their solution of the Palestine problem is to have sort of a binational state, you know, to have a country in which Jews and Arabs and Muslims and Christians, you know, have equality. And well, you know, I mean, if Netanyahu and some of these people want to not to relinquish any part of the West Bank and Gaza, and incorporate them in Israel, well, that's exactly what the Palestinians have wanted. What are they going to do with the Arab minority? I mean, they can't have 2 million people, almost 2 million people, being treated forever as second-class citizens.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's in a very strange way what the Palestinians have called for and what the Israeli extremists have been calling for is one of the same, unless the extremists think that they'll be able to drive out the Arabs from Palestine, which of course now is, I think most Israelis realize it can't be done.
Right. You may be interested in the same series of interviews. I did interview Abba Eban.
Uh-huh.
And he said, very bluntly, that in his opinion, the greatest catastrophe that had happened to Israel was the victory in 1967.
Maybe, he's right.
For this reason, that is,
yes.
That it was impossible to absorb the,
yes.
The territories within the kind of state that had been foreseen,
yeah.
By the founders of Israel.
Yes. Of course, I mean, it is suicidal, you know, to force a hostile population in the country and keep them under. I mean, it can't be done over a long period of time. But of course, the extremists want to transfer the Palestinians elsewhere. I mean, I'm sure this is one of their aims. They want to get rid of the Palestinians, or as many of them as they can. I think it's part of the, you know, the plans of the various extreme rightist parties, but I don't think it can be done. In the end, you know, the whole thing would depend on the Israeli electorate. You know, now we hear that between 60% and 70% of the Israelis don't mind withdrawing from, you know, significant parts of the West Bank.
Right.
And they don't even oppose the creation of a Palestinian state, which would be totally demilitarized and with all kinds of... The only one point on which, you know, there seems to be some problem is really the settlements. What are we going to do about the settlements? Well, I think the Palestinians now are saying, look, you don't have to dismantle all these settlements, but certainly the settlements that are going to be within the Palestinian state will have to be under Palestinian sovereignty and authority, with all kinds of international guarantees and so on and so forth. And, but of course, some of the Israelis say, no, they have to be under Israeli sovereignty. That makes it very difficult to have really a viable Palestinian state if all these settlements are spread around and they are not... I mean, can you imagine all these enclaves all around? It can happen if the two peoples were on friendly terms and there was peace between them and so on. I mean, you can have that between Canada and the United States, you know.
Right.
You could have American enclaves all over the place and the Canadian enclaves, but in the end, you know, it's up to the Israeli electorate. They have to decide what kind of Israel they want, what kind of relations they want with the Arabs. I mean, there are two points of view, it seems to me. There is one which says, "What, we don't need the Arabs. We don't. We are far more advanced than them. We have absorbed the new technological revolution, and we can, you know, have close relations with Western Europe and, of course, with the United States. And we can do without our neighbors." Of course, others like Shimon Peres say, "No, I mean, you can't do that. You have decided to create a state here in this region, so you have to be part of this region, and you have to have normal relations with your neighbors. Otherwise, you'd always be living in a ghetto, in a way." So, I mean, there are two points of view in Israel now, but still the majority, I think, support the Peres idea. And we don't know what's going to happen in 2 years' time.
Right. I want to go back just for a minute. There's one question that I did not ask, and that is back to the 67 period regarding the Secretary General Lausanne.
Yes.
What was your assessment of Lausanne in the way he managed things?
Lausanne was actually a good friend of mine. I mean, we worked together briefly as he was Prime Minister of Burma, and I was Iraq representative, and I certainly, with others, pushed his candidacy to become secretary after Hammarskjöld died. And we always maintained very good relations. You know, he's not like Hammarskjöld. I mean, I worked with Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld asked me to be undersecretary in charge of the Congo operations from New York at the time. We were very close. I think he was... He's a good man, a very decent man, and an honest man. And he depended a lot on his advisors. I mean, he's not the kind of person who would take bold initiatives. You know, he depended on... And his advisors, with the exception of Raj Panj,
mm-hmm.
were really civil servants. You know, they...
Right.
They wouldn't... They don't want to sort of upset anybody or anything. You know, they... Raj Panj, of course, had his own stature, and he depended a lot on Raj Panj. But he was very cautious with that. He wouldn't take bold initiatives or really sort of stick his neck out on anything. But he was decent, you know, and his position on 1967 is that Egypt was within its right to ask for the withdrawal of UN troops. After all, 1957, UNIF was established with the consent of both sides, and as an act of sovereignty, they accepted that some troops would be. Israel said, "No, I won't. I will not have any troops on my side of the frontier." That was an act of sovereignty too. So in 1967, when Cairo decided to withdraw the UN troops, it was acting within its sovereign rights, obviously. But that's a purely legalistic argument. You know, unfortunately, the political situation was quite different. But Uthant had to uphold the legality of the thing, because some questioned the validity, legal validity of things like this, of unilateral withdrawal at the request of the Israelis, saying that they had an understanding with the Americans, but that was an understanding Egypt was not party to. But unfortunately, the whole thing was not legal. It was a very political issue which should have been dealt in a political way. And Uthant, of course, wouldn't do that. He didn't try to mediate.
And he did not take it to the Security Council or the General Assembly?
No, he left it to the states concerned, yes. Mm-hmm. Hammarskjöld would have done differently. Hammarskjöld took a very active role in setting up the UNIF at the time, as he did in the later on in the Congo. I mean, he asked that the Congo situation should be discussed in the Security Council. And he had some very, bold initiatives and ideas, it was different. I mean, you will never have another Hammarskjöld, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Everybody else after him were really glorified civil servants.
The other question I have is with regard to Goldberg. Of course, he was Jewish.
Not only Jewish, but also an active Zionist, I think.
Well, this is my question, really. Did you view him as...
Well, I mean, he was
less than partial.
He was active in Zionist organizations, and mm-hmm. he knew that. Yes, I mean, obviously, the way he talked, the way he negotiated, obviously he had Israel's interest in mind. Of course, he tried to express it. He was a very, very intelligent man, obviously, very capable. But from the very beginning, when he steadfastly refused that there should be in the ceasefire resolution that was adopted on the 6th of June, mm-hmm. that there should be a call for withdrawal. I mean, usually in such cases, there is a call for withdrawal to the positions that were held before the conflict.
Except in the case of the Iran-Iraq war.
Iran-Iraq war, yes. But the Iran-Iraq war actually, at the end, I don't think there were any areas which were occupied by
Arabs. No, but the Security Council didn't call for a ceasefire until after Iraq was well within.
Yes, yes.
And it didn't include a call for it.
No, because, I mean, Iraq was considered in 1988 as the lesser of two evils. Of course, they learned otherwise 2 years later.
I wanted at the end to ask if there were any other points, especially with regard to this 1967 period, that you would like to put on the record here.
Well, I mean, obviously, in our opinion, in my opinion, the 1967 war was not a spontaneous act of self-defense, as the Israelis like to show. But I think it was part of a plan calculated and really refined over the years to just seize the right opportunity and the right time to inflict a heavy defeat on the Arabs. I don't say with the aim of occupying more land. Possibly this was also part of the plan, but I think the main aim of the plan really was to by inflicting this defeat on the Arabs, then the Arabs would come to their senses and really settle the whole problem by recognizing Israel within it, as Abba Ibn has indicated here, that probably. Maybe that was his hope, because he was foreign minister of Israel when 1967.
Right.
And he was hoping that with this defeat, the Arabs would finally be reconciled to the existence of Israel, and that they have to have normal relations with them. And but of course, things didn't progress that way, unfortunately. That would have been really, it was a golden opportunity in 1967-68. I still don't know whether, you say that they were prepared. I don't know. Of course, we will never know, will we? We will never know.
No. No. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you. I hope you found our conversation useful.
Very useful.